Mac Power Users, episode 735, Catching Up with Ryan J.A. Murphy. Hello, everyone. It's David Sparks. Stephen Hackett could not be here this week, but that's okay. We've got a guest with you this week on the Mac Power Users, and when I heard Stephen couldn't make it, this guy was at the top of my list. Welcome back to the show, Ryan J.A. Murphy.
Thanks, David. Sorry, Stephen couldn't be here, but yeah, we'll have fun without him.
Yeah, I know. Well, you know, the thing is, cat's away, man. So we're going to talk about Obsidian. You know, we're going to maybe talk about Jazz. It's like all the stuff that Stephen usually, you know, keeps me under control on.
We're going to go nuts
right now. If Stephen listens to this show, I'm sure he will. He'll be like, I can never do that again. These guys, they're uncontrollable. But we do have an episode for you today where we're going to be talking about stuff. Ryan first came to my knowledge, Ryan, for you through Obsidian, because you have done so many contributions with Obsidian, but you've guested on the show. But you know, not everybody knows you, Ryan. Tell us a little bit about you for folks at home not aware.
Sure. Yeah. So as I mentioned in the pre-show, to you, David, I'm calling in from my office on the university campus. So I'm an assistant professor at Memorial University's Grenfell campus in Newfoundland, Labrador. If anybody knows where Newfoundland is, then points to you. I'm a researcher. I do a bit of consulting work. I help people work through complex problems. And David and I happily had the chance to meet up only a couple of months ago because I was visiting California to do some work with a client there. And you and I visited an Apple store. So that was pretty cool.
Yeah. As you do with friends. Let's go to the Apple store together. Apple store and sushi. Exactly. That's the full California experience right there.
Yeah. I'm still confused as to where you store your snowblowers, but.
Yeah. Well, you know, we keep them very well stored. Although, you know, the funny thing is like where I didn't talk to you about this when you visited, but where I live, I'm very fortunate because I could be in the ocean in a half hour, but I could be in the snow in about an hour because we have mountains here. So at the right time of year, they actually do have snow blowers up there. In fact, it was funny because Mike Schmitz visited last year. We did a retreat with some friends and up in the mountains. And he says, man, I can't imagine driving in these mountains in the snow because they're very steep and, you know, switchbacks and everything. And I thought, well, he comes from Wisconsin. He should be used to the snow. But no, it's flat there and it is not flat here.
Well, just to continue the sideways commentary, I'm not that far off here. I could probably beat you. I can get to the ocean in 15 minutes or to the mountains in 15 minutes, but you don't want to go into the ocean here. It wouldn't be very nice.
Very cold, I bet.
Exactly, yeah.
You glossed over your area of study and consulting, but the thing that Ryan does, and one of the reasons why I enjoy talking to you so much is you literally have made a career out of process.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
Tell us a little bit about it.
Yeah. So my research is in, I have a couple of different streams of research that might interest folks, but I'd say the two key ones are I study information systems and design science, which is probably of most interest to listeners of MPU, where the study of design science is literally how exactly did we design technology to work, and does it work the way we think it does? So maybe we'll get into it a little bit maybe later, but one of the ideas that I've been working on there is this idea of workflow design theories. Actually, it's not in the show notes at all, so we probably won't get to it, but I can perhaps follow up on the forum, the MPU forum later if folks are interested. But it's this idea that, what exactly is the, are you trying to achieve with a given workflow? Can you like explain that before you go off and start tinkering with tools? What are the design principles that would help you actually achieve that workflow? And how do you know if it's successful or not? What are the success conditions and how do you test those? I've been playing with that lately in my design science research. And it seems to be some interesting ideas, or it seems maybe a potentially valuable idea.
So this will be the first example of Stephen not being here and me going off script. I want to talk about that because I do think a lot of people that listen to the show are interested in that. I mean, our listeners, a lot of times have run small businesses, doctors, lawyers, you know, all these people that are interested in process. That's why they listen to the show. But there's really not a lot of common knowledge or literature about how do you know if it's working or not? And what are the consequences of process that we may not realize? Can you give us just a little peek into your world on how people should be thinking about this stuff?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, one of the things, maybe this will make my colleague scholars angry, but one of the things that I am always kind of disappointed about in information systems is that it's always super scholarly, you know, academics, that's how they like to be, dress it up in a lot of jargon. And as a result, there's all these great ideas buried in information systems and design science, that don't make it out to, you know, the average user. A peek into that world is simply, I just said it, but I would argue, or I would suggest that folks listening to this show looking for new ways of working and working better, really try to sit back and think about exactly if they're going to go off and tinker with a new toy before you go off and try the next version of OmniFocus or switch your note-taking app again. Sit back and think, what are you really trying to achieve here? Like, what is the problem that you're trying to solve with this given workflow? And can you really like explain what that problem is? What's the context for it? What are you hoping to do? And what are the success conditions? Like, how do you know if you've succeeded when you've solved that problem? And then from there, you can actually break it down a bit further and identify design principles that are the kinds of things you want to change about your workflow in order to achieve that or to solve that overall problem that you've just described. So a design principle, I did this with time tracking and time blocking, and maybe we will get into this later. But I was interested in time tracking for a while, like everybody or many listeners of this show, and like you have as well. And I was trying to figure out, you know, what am I actually trying to achieve with time tracking? And I realized that the problem I was trying to solve was spending my time with intention, right? And so I wrote down some stuff about what exactly that looked like, what that problem was, and came up with a few design principles. And I can pull them up and look at them. I haven't looked at it in a while. But design principles like, if I'm really trying to be intentional about my time, then I should be able to articulate the kinds of things that I want to achieve with my time. And I came up with a time budget from that. So one design principle was, you know, can I articulate a time budget? Can I actually write down a list of categories that I want to spend and estimate how much time I want to spend in each of these categories? And then the second one was, can I track that effectively and actually use what I learn week over week in order to gauge and change my habits so that I'm spending my time appropriately? So I don't know if that makes sense. Did that make any sense to you?
Yeah, it does. In fact, if you don't mind, go ahead and pull up the document just so people listening can get an idea of how you would do this. So maybe they can emulate some of it.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I don't know how well it's going to, I don't know how well it's going to translate to audio, but let me see. Some of the design principles: use a time budget to prioritize time spending, use timers to track how much time is being spent in each relevant category, automate the triggering and shut off of timers to increase the accuracy and completeness of time tracking, and track time for insights, not for posterity, were the four high-level design principles that I came up with. And I can break those. I did break those down a lot more. And I know I went through those kind of quick. But the ultimate sort of takeaway from that was, instead of just time tracking because it seemed like a cool thing to do, I actually had a pretty directed and intentional reason to engage in time blocking, Time blocking is a different thing. And I actually like it quite a bit more. But yeah, I was able to engage in this for a couple of months, and the end result was actually that I stopped time tracking. I'm thinking maybe about getting back into it for a different reason, but I learned what I needed to learn, which is, by the way, as a to give it away, having kids and trying to spend your time intentionally are just like paradoxical things.
Yeah. I mean, I think with all of this time blocking and time tracking, you have to give yourself grace and understand that life is not as predictable as you'd like it to be. And as you said, with children, even more so. But to some extent, I think that makes the intentionality, the struggle for intentionality, even more important, that you take advantage of it when you can. But I love that you kind of decided the job to be done before you pick the tool. And then you document it. So there's a couple things there. I have a document I call Sparky's Tech Stack. And It's a live mm-hmm. document that I have, and I have all these topics under it, email, task management, calendar, all the main major tools I use. And I document what I use and why. And if I decide mm-hmm. to move something, I have to explain to myself why. You know, what is the old tool doing that this isn't doing that I need? Does it work? You know, there's kind of a forced experimentation period before I commit. And mm-hmm. and I look at this over time, and it's a really good way for me to kind of justify the move, but also make sure I make it more intentional.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's brilliant. And I recommend everybody try to engage in something like that. Otherwise, you get you're subject to, what's it called? Crimping? I forget what crimping stands for. It came out of the outliner community.
I've never heard the term.
It's a make-believe malady defined in 2006 on outlinersoftware.com. And it's called compulsive reactive information management purchasing. Symptoms include never being satisfied with your current system of information management, continuously being on the lookout for something newer and better, purchasing every new program you hear about, and secretly hoping that you won't find the perfect tool because then you'll have to stop looking for better ones.
Yeah, that's, they could also call it sparkying.
Yeah.
although, you know, in fairness, like I am pretty settled on my tech stack. You know, I've been using OmniFocus for 15 years. I do go and look at the other stuff and spend time in with them because I talk about it for a living and I want to be familiar. But at the end of the day, that's the tool I use. And the same thing with my notes and calendar app and stuff. But the idea of documenting the use for it is, to me, really important because I think that's what keeps you from jumping to the new hotness every week. But I'd never thought about it as predefining the job to be done, which you did. And right. I think that is, that's the professor move there.
Mm. Right? Or at least the design scientists. I like to say that we're all designers, right? We, to design something is to designate what's important about it. And so everybody's engaged in design all the time. It's just usually implicit, but making it explicit and really fighting with yourself to try and understand what exactly you're trying to do and why and how you'll know if it's successful is so important. One of the areas to bring it back, one of the areas that I hope to research in my career is exactly how to help the average end user figure out how to do this with their own sort of tech stack in a systematic and scientific way.
Yeah, I mean, because if you look at it, there is a... there's a name of it. It's the curve where like you get the most bang for your buck. Like when you first put time into something, you get a massive amount of return for little investment. But then at some point, it's, I guess, what they call diminishing returns. And mm-hmm. there's a curve to that. Like, and for normal users, and this is probably not the Mac Power Users audience, there's a lot of people who have not even approached the curve. They get zero bang for their buck because they've not tried anything. But there is a point where it stops becoming useful. And figuring that out, I think, probably needs to be part of the process.
Yeah. And that reminds me of another thing that I've been thinking about a lot. We're both engaged in sort of the personal knowledge management world. And I've been thinking about IQ. Can we get there? Can we go there? Steven's not here. We can go in all kinds of weird directions.
Yeah.
So IQ is this old idea, right? The intelligence quotient. And it's been largely sort of blown up and debunked. And there's a lot of, there's a lot sort of true about IQ, but there's a lot that's also sort of needless in terms of discussions about IQ. But I've been thinking about, as it relates to crimping and our sort of pursuit of better workflows and better technology. And there's got to be some new idea of IQ that takes sort of your baseline potential and measures whether or not or how easily you're able to augment that by using technology, by using tools, right? How much better off are we if we can automate some of the things that we're bad at, for instance? And is there a way of sort of gauging that for ourselves at least and then judging when we want to make a change, does it increase that new quotient or not? I think there's something really powerful there that isn't really discussed. And yet we're all knowledge workers, right? We're all using knowledge and creating knowledge. And so how do we measure how well we're doing at that? And can we get better ways of doing that measurement and thinking about it?
Well, I would recommend, if you're curious about that question, there's a brand new book out from Cal Newport called Slow Productivity. And he opens up the book talking about the problem of measuring knowledge work, you know, and, you know, productivity, as he explains in the book, started out with farms. I mean, farms, mm-hmm. it's very easy to measure the productivity of a farm, you know. How many bananas did this orchard give us in this amount of time? Well, that's productivity. But when it comes to knowledge work, it's not so easy. And you're stumbling right into the topic of that book. So I would recommend checking it out. But cool. But I do also think that the idea of, technology enhanced IQ is something that has merit. Like I don't mm-hmm. personally feel like I'm that smart. I mean, going through school, I never tested, in the advanced stuff, but I always graded really well because from a very early age, I felt like I understood how to use process to my mm-hmm. benefit. And so I do think that there's definitely something to that. I hope you pursue that at some point. This episode of the Mac Power Users is brought to you by 1Password. Go to 1Password.com/MPU today and get 20% off your plan. Protecting yourself online is more difficult than ever because there's so many ways the bad guys can get at your data. That's why you need someone in your corner. And for that, I recommend 1Password. With 1Password, you can manage your online security from a single place. They've got everything you need: secured password sharing, automatic password generation, and even more importantly, data breach alerts. They look for the services you work with and let you know when there's a problem. And all of that is at your fingertips with 1Password. From passwords to passkeys and everything in between, like signing in with Google, Apple, Microsoft, and other providers, 1Password makes it easy. And because it's one source, there's just one place to go looking for your passwords. You can stop hunting for information. Save and fill usernames, passwords, two-factor authentication codes, form fields, all that stuff is included with 1Password. Years ago, I started using 1Password for all of my two-factor authentications, and now I always know that's the place I go. It's the app that's always with me, and it's always ready to go. And it's not just passwords. You can store other confidential data like credit cards, medical records, and other important data all in 1Password behind the 1Password vault. It's like a second layer of security. And then you can securely share it with your family or send individual secrets to anyone, even if they don't use 1Password. And the last thing I want to emphasize with 1Password is Watchtower. Watchtower gives you the information you need to stay safe and protect yourself. And it's all right in 1Password. It can identify weak passwords, generate strong ones, and get you notified about vulnerabilities like data breaches with websites you use. And all of that fits in 1Password that's on all of your devices. I've been trusting 1Password for a long time. Since the company first started, they really care about your security. And if you want to protect yourself on the internet, go check them out. Go to 1Password.com/MPU today to get 20% off, whether you're setting up an individual, a family, a company plan, whatever they got you covered. So go to 1Password.com today and start protecting yourself. Thanks, 1Password, for all of your support of the Mac Power Users over the years. All right, Ryan, we are being too cruel to Steven. He would definitely be in on all this stuff, but it's just fun to make fun of him when he's not here. You know how it goes.
Exactly. Yeah,
but we do, you are on the Mac Power Users, and you need to prove your bona fides, as I say. Mm-hmm. Since you're here, tell us about your Apple gear, what you're using, and what you like and don't like.
Sure. Yeah. So it speaks to sort of where we are in Apple technology, Apple hardware these days. But I don't think my tools have changed. My hardware has changed at all since the last time I was on the show, which was, yeah, I think, 2 years ago. And so maybe it's just the phone upgrade, but I don't know if I can even really tell the difference between the iPhone 15 Pro Max that I've got now and the, I think it was the 13 that I had before, the 13 Pro Max. It got wet, so I had to upgrade. Otherwise, I might not have. Still rocking a MacBook Pro. I think it's a Pro Max. I still have a disused iPad Pro that I occasionally pull out and then sort of feel disappointed in, and still using my iPhone 15, all right, 15 Pro Max. Just to make people mad.
I want to hear about that. So what makes you disappointed in the iPad?
Whenever I go to use it, which is, whenever I think to use it, which is pretty rare, it's not charge because I forgot to plug it in because I don't use it. So it's just sort of cyclical.
Well, that is on you, right? That is,
yeah, of course.
Yeah.
But it's pretty rare, maybe because I have the large phone and maybe because I'm quite used to using the phone. It's just very rare that I reach for the iPad. There's lots of rants about this that I've posted around, but it's great that some people are able to use the iPad Pro, and I don't, I love that for them, love that journey for them, but I just have not found it to be that handy of a tool compared to the other two. So,
and I also think, I mean, there's other factors here. Like mm-hmm. you're on Apple Silicon, so you're on the, you know, you're on the new chip. I believe it's EM2, correct?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. And you know, the Apple Silicon brought the Mac, it brought a lot of the prior failings of the Mac, but the things that distinguished it from the iPad now are not mm-hmm. distinguishable.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we got instant on, we got long battery life, we got a lot of the features in the Mac now that we historically only had in the iPad.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And the operating system isn't, you know, hamstrung.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and that, honestly, that's a fair way to say it. I mean,
yeah.
Apple's view of the iPad is very different of the Mac. The Mac is this platform that can be ubiquitous, and the iPad is much more opinionated, in my feelings.
Sorry, there is another word for that, opinionated or paternalistic. I really think that it's... and I think I talked about this even last episode that I was on, but there's an idea in design science and systemic design called design paternalism.
Okay.
And it's this idea that it's inherent to design. When somebody is designing a tool, they have to be paternalistic. They have to do something where they have to act as if they know better than the user in some way. But the degree to which you're paternalistic can definitely be changed. And I feel like when it comes to the Mac, Apple is a lot less paternalistic than when it comes to the iPad. And I don't want people to tell me how I should use my computer. I want to be able to access all levels of the file system and the operating system and hook them all together in all the beautiful ways that you're able to do with the Mac. And so that's really the core of it for me is like, yes, all these Apple Silicon advantages are amazing. But I think the ultimate lesson that I've learned over the past 2 to 3 years is that I really wanted the iPad to be this beautiful writing, annotation, and highlighting machine. That's the primary use case for it for me is reading papers, right? Reading reading for productivity. And I think it was actually in the early days of the Readwise Reader beta when I was still playing with Reader. I don't use it anymore, but I was waiting for the iPad app to come out, right? It wasn't out right away. The first iteration of Reader was desktop only. And I remember reading the rationale for why it wasn't being prioritized. And they said something like, we kind of believe that you should do your reading at a desk with like your work in front of you. And I don't want to put words in anybody's mouth. I might be completely misquoting that, but it made me pause. And I started to question like, why do I want a tablet to be able to do that kind of reading and annotating workflow? Because frankly, it is kind of slow to pick up an iPad, use the pencil to highlight text and then try to sort of type using the software keyboard into the iPad. Or like what I was doing for a while was clicking the iPad back into a keyboard and typing and then clicking it back off. And it's like, why don't I just sit down at a desk and use a mouse and keyboard for that? And I think the root of it was in skeuomorphism, you know, that old idea. Yeah. I think I was treating this iPad as the skeuomorphic book or paper. And it was that adherence to that mental model I had of what reading should be that made me try to work with the iPad as much as I did. And when I finally got rid of that, I think I'm happier for it. I'm not struggling with and fighting with the sort of lack of being able to get data into and out of the iPad and its apps in the same fluidity that I'm able to do on the Mac. So that's the story.
Yeah, no, I get it. But I do think like to counter that, like I spent 30 Please. Years writing as a lawyer and so lots of long briefs and research and whatnot. And I often found that like I could work on something on a computer for hours and maybe days, but when I printed it out and looked at it in a printed form, I found sometimes typos, but also sometimes logic errors or other things that just didn't jump out to me when it was on a screen. So I think when you say skeuomorphism, I think it's more than just not being at your desk, where some people, I think it's just that change in format that can help them. Although, yeah. Does that translate to a digital screen? Does it need to be printed in order for me to do it? For me, I found that using an iPad did give me the same feel, and I did find errors that I didn't find the other ways. But Macs are really powerful and screens are really big, and there's a good argument that, you know, you could do it all at your desk.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it goes back to that idea that we were talking about earlier about a sort of personal technology IQ score or something like that. It's like, Is there a real advantage for you? And is that contextual for who you are? Maybe it is. And that's great. I wonder, there's certainly lots of research out there saying, for instance, that the creation of memory is often better when you're writing with a pen or pencil versus typing on a computer. And I'm not an expert on that literature. I can't say for certain. The question that I have is, does that change when you have generations of people who come up with keyboards more than pencils? And I'm not sure.
I'm leery on that too. I'm not sure that we know that it's better to write or type or whatever dictate. But I'm with you. One of the things I've always admired about you, though, and because you and I have talked quite a bit offline as well, is that you're very cognizant of your tools and your software and your hardware tools and how they work together. I remember you were kind enough to guest in the Obsidian Field Guide webinar series. And one of my gripes with Obsidian, as much as I like it, is I'm just not a fan of the mobile app. It just feels a little hard to me. Mm-hmm. And then you said to me, well, I just don't use it that way. And you use it on your Mac. And I was like, yeah, you know, sometimes I think that's, as technology enthusiasts, sometimes we focus in on something that's not good or something that's, you know, less than ideal with an app. And we don't ask ourselves, well, do I even care? You're so good at cutting through that, I think, with the decision. Maybe it's because of your training or just the way you're wired. But I always appreciate hearing your opinion on things like that.
Well, for the record, I would say it's survivorship bias. I'm not sharing all of the floundering that I'm doing with my own workflow rabbit holes, but I appreciate the compliment.
Yeah. Vision Pro, is that interesting at all to you?
Yeah, I mean, I'm curious as to, I listened to the episode you and Stephen recorded on it a couple weeks ago, and I'm interested in your continued productivity uses of it. I don't have one. I tried to figure out if there was some way I could justify spending research budget on it and couldn't come up with anything. Otherwise, no, I haven't bought it. Definitely interested in it. What I've read and watched so far in terms of reviews seem to indicate that it's not a great sort of long-term productivity use case, not yet. Is that still your experience? I know you were starting to say that there is some experiences you were having with it that were pretty good.
I think as for me, the people in my racket, right, the podcasters, bloggers, YouTubers, whatever, get them and say, well, you know, this is something I want to talk about in the stuff I do. And that's actually got some truth for me. Like, I think the Mac Sparky Labs people in particular are curious, and I'm the canary in the coal mine. It's a lot, it's very expensive. I mean, I could have bought a new table saw for what I spent on this thing, but, so they're happy to have me buy it and report in. But the thing I've noticed in talking to a bunch of my friends in the racket is that they're all telling me, well, yeah, it's good for, I'm glad I have it, and it's good for, you know, covering, but I'm not sure how much I'll use it. And I'm finding that I actually have dedicated uses for it already. I'm already sold on it as a unitasker device. I mean, kind of getting back to our iPad discussion, this is not a Mac. It will never replace a Mac, at least in its current iteration. But it is very good at a couple tasks that the Mac isn't particularly good at. And I think the writing environment to me absolutely works. You know, putting myself in a foreign environment, taking myself out of my office and having a keyboard and just a screen in front of me, I'm getting some really great writing done in that is a contextual shift. So that's what it can do for me. There's a couple other contexts I've been working on. I think journaling is another one. I'm working on the idea of ideation. You can tell me, is ideation a word? I sure keep is. Using it. Okay. Good. Yep. That makes me feel better because I've been using it a little freely lately. But the idea of just like putting myself in a space and working on concepts around an idea, it's just isolating focus. I think to me, it has a use for that. There is a bunch of downsides. You know, it costs as much as a table saw. It's heavy on your face. It has a battery attached to a cord, which I literally put it down my shirt like a microphone cord because I'm afraid I'm going to snag it on something when I'm walking around a whiteboard. And so there's a whole bunch of cost to it, but I see use for it that I actually now am starting to like rely upon. Like, oh, I need to write that thing. It's going to be about 3,000 words. I really need to do a good job on this. Okay, I'm going to block a couple hours and get into the chair and wire myself into the matrix, you know. So I'm finding use for it, but it's not, you know, it's not going to replace the Mac anytime soon.
It's funny thinking about you jacking into a chair. Apple just optioned Neuromancer. I'm not sure if you've ever read Neuromancer, William Gibson, but it's the original sort of cyberspace book. Yeah. And that is exactly the image now that I have of you is jacking into the to the matrix. To cyberspace with your deck.
I do think there's a long-term story here that I think it's, to me, feels pretty. I think Apple is making a play that this is going to be what replaces the iPhone, and maybe in 10 years or something. But at some point, you know, all these screens in our life that, you know, when you think about it, we're surrounded by screens. You got a screen on your desk, you got a screen on your wall, got a screen in your pocket, got a screen on your wrist. At some point, I think the idea is you put on a pair of glasses and you can have all those screens with you all the time. And I think that that's what the ultimate kind of iteration of this is, but it's not there now. But for now, I think for a productivity story, you can use it as a focus mode. I've been trying to do email and calendar and stuff in it and with mixed results. I'm not sure if that's something that's going to stick with me, but it's an interesting bit of technology. It is not a Mac, you know, it's like,
it's not a Mac. Sure. But like you said, it is able to do some things that the Mac isn't good at. And in fact, the Mac isn't capable of at all. So the contextual stuff that you're talking about, the putting yourself in a literal space is a fascinating concept. And it's actually something that I wanted to ask you directly about because you talked about it in that episode on the Vision Pro. And it reminded me of some research that was done on, I think it's called the cathedral effect. But there's actually an observed phenomenon where if you ask people to come up with big ideas, but you put them in a basement with low ceilings versus if you put them in a cathedral with huge high ceilings, they actually tend to come up with bigger, more dramatic ideas in the bigger, more beautiful space. And so I can't cite that source. I heard it on a podcast a number of years ago. I can find it for the show notes if necessary. But I was curious about, you know, if that's actually the one idea that I thought of that maybe it's worth submitting some sort of small research grant requests for $3,500 US to buy a Vision Pro to test that idea. Can you simulate the cathedral effect with a Vision Pro? But it's no joke, this idea that you can put yourself somewhere else and make your body, I mean, you're all about the extended mind. That book, I haven't read it, I should. But I think there's some real effects there on how technology relates to our minds and our bodies and how it can transform what we're capable of. Have you experienced that? It sounds like you're really liking the putting yourself in a different space with it while writing. Do you think that could be where it's coming from?
Yeah, absolutely. I think I'm experiencing that. Maybe I'm just particularly susceptible to it because I read that book and I understand that there's something to this, but putting myself in expansive surroundings makes a difference. Like I only use the Yosemite environment to write. I don't go there for anything else. And, you know, and I'm trying to curate those environments to different modes. And, and maybe this is just me being a hack and trying to be silly, but I feel like there is a benefit of it. And, when I sit down in Yosemite and I open up the text editor and, you know, it just feels like, okay, it's game time. And of course I use focus modes and other things to make sure that when I go there, I'm not bothered. So that's a whole, you know, I think if you were to do an experiment, maybe that's something you have to address, but it really does make a difference for me. And is it a $3,500 difference? I don't know, but I am super interested in this topic of finding ways to use technology with our brains in a way that gets the best work out of us with the lowest amount of friction. And I think there's really something to this. And the funny thing is when you think into the future of this, and if this does turn into just a pair of glasses, you won't have that benefit. I won't be able to go to Yosemite. And that's why I feel convinced that in 10 years, Apple will maybe have a pair of glasses, but they'll also have still some kind of virtual environment device that will be even better. But it's good enough now. I mean, my brain is fooled. I mean, they've got, they've got the sound and they've got the visuals of it. So much so that I was in Yosemite in the snow and I was like in my socks and I felt like my feet were cold. And I think it was just my brain playing a trick on me because, you know, I mean, it's very strange what our brains do to us.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think there's something there and I think you're probably right. I never really thought about it before, but there probably will be two tracks, the spatial, the purely AR spatial device that is a pair of glasses that acts otherwise just like a regular pair of glasses. And then probably a immersive VR AR spatial computing device that continues on the lineage of the Vision Pro as it is now. That makes sense. The other piece though, I didn't want to lose this thread to go back to what we were talking about reading and using the iPad and printing things out and how that changes things. I think there's probably something to that too. You talked in your, in the previous episode of the Vision Pro, you talked about laying out all of your ideas on a big whiteboard and the effects that that has.
Yeah.
And there is something to that too, I think. I suspect that there's something about how our, you know, a hippocampus, the part of the brain that's mostly focused on mapping and spatial sort of coordination. There's definitely an effect there where when we're trying to lay out a bunch of index cards on a sheet of, on a big desk in order to make sense of something, that spatial effect probably lends to a bit of augmented cognition, right?
Yeah.
And so I'm guessing that the Vision Pro is going to help people tap into that idea too, which is exciting.
I mean, this technology, compared to entire human existence, technology is probably not even a blink. It's just so brief. And our brains have evolved around hunter-gatherer, you know, problems and spatial awareness. And so I feel like there's really, we might as well use the technology to take advantage of our existing wiring.
Right. That's absolutely true.
This episode of the Mac Power Users is brought to you by NetSuite. Go to netsuite.com/MPU for the leading integrated cloud business software suite, where you can download NetSuite's popular KPI checklist designed to give you consistently excellent performance. If you have a business, you might be able to relate to this. Your business gets a certain size and the cracks start to emerge. Things you used to do in a day are taking a week. You have too many manual processes and you don't have one source of truth. It's never a good feeling when everything in your business is disjointed. Too many processes in too many places. You want clarity, and you want one place where all the important stuff happens. The solution to untangling that disjointed feeling is NetSuite. NetSuite is a software company that has developed a cloud-based business management platform to help your team deal with key business processes like enterprise resource planning and financials, CRM, e-commerce, inventory, and more. I've dealt with a lot of businesses over my career, and I know what it's like when you first get started. You just make the thing and you do that well and the customers love it and everything's great. But before you know it, things start accumulating. All that background noise becomes your focus and you're unable to get back to making the thing. It feels like it slips out of your hands and getting work done feels hard. Like you can't be as productive or successful as you'd like to be in your business because of all those interruptions. Well, NetSuite is here to solve that. If you want to make sure the cracks don't emerge in your business, you should know these three numbers, 36,000, 25, 1. All right, so what do those numbers mean? 36,000, that's the number of businesses that have upgraded to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, streamlining accounting, financial management, inventory, HR, and more. 25 is because NetSuite turns 25 this year. That's 25 years of helping businesses do more with less, close their books in days, not weeks, and drive down costs. And one, because your business is one of a kind. So You get a customized solution for all of your KPIs in one efficient system with one source of truth. Management risk, get reliable forecasts, and improve margins. Everything you need to grow all in one place. Having all the information you need in one place makes it so much easier to make decisions. I know as a business owner myself what a difference that can make and how much easier everything operates when information is available. It really means the smart decisions can be made faster. So right now, download NetSuite's popular KPI checklist designed to give you consistently excellent performance absolutely free at netsuite.com/MPU. That's netsuite.com/MPU to get your own KPI checklist, netsuite.com/MPU. Go there now and get that free KPI checklist and make sure your business continues to thrive. And our thanks to NetSuite for their support of the Mac Power Users and all of Relay FM. So we've been talking about your teaching and the research you do, but I wanted to get a little bit into your workflows because you are interestingly using AI and ChatGPT with some of the work you're doing. And I'm really excited about sharing those topics with the audience because I think this is things that a lot of people are curious about if they can make use of it. So what led you to this rabbit hole, right?
Sure. Yeah. So let's see, a few caveats because we need to lay them all out. This is definitely sort of trepidatious, dramatic, controversial waters. I don't think anybody should use these tools yet without being a subject matter expert in whatever they're using it for. And I think you've said the same on the show before. And I know, was it Jeff Richardson was another guest you had recently who talked about it, the same idea. Yeah, the same idea. You should definitely not trust these machines to do anything smart if you can't catch that error. So that's one sort of caveat. And then the other one is there's lots out there now about whether or not these are even ethical tools. And I'm not an ethicist. I'm interested in where that goes. Certainly willing to trust the ethical experts on, you know, and the legal experts on whether or not these tools were trained on New York Times' entire catalog of content sort of illegally. And then therefore, maybe we should, out of respect to the authors and the journalists who train these tools, not use them until they're properly paid, et cetera, et cetera. There's a lot of like sort of mess around whether or not these tools are or should be used and how they should be used.
And I'll add to that one more is privacy. These tools are not necessarily private. So anything you're sending to them is going to somebody's server.
Yeah. It's the rare case where not only are you using the product, but you are also the product. You know, you're paying them, but also they're using you to train the tool as well. So, you've got a double cost effect there. But still, you know, I can't help but be interested, from the areas of research that I do, I can't help but be interested in whether or not these tools are effective at all and how to make them effective. And so, I don't know if anybody's talked on the show in recent history about, prompt crafting and prompt engineering. I know there's been some discussions on the forum about it. But it's really fascinating to me how much better and worse interactions with a generative tool like ChatGPT can be, depending on how you're able to prompt craft it and guide it. And so do you want me to just dive into the sort of recent use case I had?
Yeah, like prompt crafting, just for folks who aren't aware, it's the idea of what's the request you send? It's like the old days with Google. If you knew how to ask Google, you got better answers. Eventually, that didn't become as much of an issue. Google got so smart. But we're in the early days with AI, and the way you ask it a question can make a huge difference on what it tells you.
Absolutely. And it's changing day to day. It's like a rapid fire thing you need to keep up with. And one of my interests in this area is I'm teaching students how to use technology, right? So that's literally my part of my job description as a professor in information systems. So I feel responsible for at least experimenting with these things and understanding what their limits are so that I can teach students to use them effectively and ethically as well. So the recent experiment that I ran was I had to redesign some part of a course, and I was curious about how well ChatGPT could help me with this, what it would be like. So I didn't really have a design theory going into it to critique myself from half an hour ago. But the question was, you know, are these tools able to generate useful information at all or not? So I use a tool called MindMac. I'm definitely open to other suggestions. There's certainly a lot of other software, a lot of other apps out there that are tapping into like the OpenAI API or other models in order to help you use these tools and gain access to them. MindMac is, so far, it's pretty good. It's a little slow at times. So I'm definitely interested in alternatives. And that's the app itself. It's not the ChatGPT sort of waiting for responses. It's just the UI can be a bit clunky. Yeah. But it's also, MindMac is kind of the ideal power user version of this because it gives you all kinds of settings and configurations and just ways of customizing it. So I'm inclined to like it a lot. It's just that clunkiness was really frustrating for me. But anyway, I use MindMac. And one of the first things that it did is MindMac actually gives you a set of sort of optional prompts that you can start with or roles that you can give the tool in order to aid it. And one of them is actually to act as a, this is so meta, but act as a generator for prompt crafting. And so you tell the tool to be really good at creating prompts for itself. And then you give it sort of what you're trying to do, and it creates this really rich descriptive role that it's going to give itself. So that was the first iteration that I did. And then I took that, cleared the chat, started a new context-free sort of conversation with ChatGPT, and gave it that role. And then I had this really interesting experience where I started out with an outline for what I wanted this module to look like. And I asked it for a response, like, you know, generate some content that follows this outline. And it was frankly junk. Like it wasn't, that first iteration made no sense at all. And again, because I'm a content expert, I could tell that it was junk. And I said something like, no, try again. But here's some more parameters. I want you to cite these sources. I want you to use these particular sort of topics that I'm talking about. And I want you to start out only giving me the first sort of section of this module. And so it tried. It gave this mod this first introductory section. And I read it and reviewed. And it was better, much better. Still had some issues. So I rewrote it, of course. And that's the other caveat that I didn't include earlier is, you know, you never, at least if you're an academic, you can never copy and paste these things, right? Because that is a form of plagiarism. So I think my personal take on it is that it's okay to use these tools as a rubber duck, right? This idea that it's something to talk through that your problems with that is a bit smarter than the rubber duck that the that the legendary programmer where the rubber duck story came from has on their desk.
Yeah.
So it's a smarter rubber duck, and that's how I treat it. Is you can talk to it, it can help you think through things, but then you've got to write it in your own words, of course. So I rewrote this content, this first section of the module, gave it back to the tool and said, that was okay. What you presented was okay, but here's how I modified it, and here's the final result. So take this and then continue and write the second section. And so I iterated like that over the course of, it was quite an effort, took a few hours. But the end result, after going back and forth like that and offering corrections and continuing to guide the tool in order to, you know, understand what I was looking for and, again, the kinds of content I wanted to talk about and so on, I think the end result was a better module than I would have been able to write on my own. And, of course, the key thing, the most important thing, is that it was probably a lot faster than if I had tried to just sit and write this big piece of work all on my own. So in the end, I was impressed in two ways. I was impressed at the ability for this tool to actually generate useful content with a lot of handholding. But I was also impressed at the sort of skill required, right? Because I started out just with a basic understanding of prompt crafting and at the level of instruction these tools need. But it's pretty clear that there really is, for future knowledge workers, a skill and a practice required in order to figure out how to talk to these machines and use them effectively. So that's the full story.
And that's why I want to talk about it on the show. I think people should be experimenting with these tools, not to do your work for you, but maybe to give you a way to generate ideas or kind of check your work and see what if it finds out. Like if you came up with a syllabus and you'd say, you know, what would you add to this or, you know, have it check it. You know, I'm really kind of jumping the line here a lot with the query generation. Mm-hmm. But sometimes it does find things for you that you're like, oh, yeah, that's something I should consider. Mm-hmm. But the idea of having it right for you is insane, I think, at least at this point. Maybe someday it'll get better. But it is, as I keep referring to, it's like an intern. And sometimes an intern does good work and sometimes an intern is completely off base. And right. That's kind of where it's at. But it's something that you can have working for you. I want to go back, though, to the choice of tool of MindMac. So I've been playing a lot with ChatGPT as well. I went ahead and paid for an account, at least for the meantime. And I've just been using it in the web interface, which is good. But that's $20 a month. With MindMac, I guess you just get an API from OpenAI and you plug it into the app. I mean, did you choose MindMac over the ChatGPT interface?
Yeah, it's, I just like the idea that I've got a personal command line into this tool instead of having to use a browser to get to it. So that was probably the main motivator. But then when I looked at the features that are offered by MindMac, and I think there's another one called MacGPT, and there's a variety of others that are coming out now that are basically just wrappers around the OpenAI API and other models. One of the neat things that we're starting to see and that I'm really hoping, and it seems like we're going to see with the next iteration of iOS, is more local models. So that's the dream. Local for the listeners means there's no call being made to a remote database somewhere where you're training, a for-profit model for them. It's all sort of based on your device, and therefore it's a lot more private. And hopefully the dream is that we get to a place where we're using what's called retrieval augmented generation, where the tool itself is not just a... So GPT stands for generative pre-trained transformer. So retrieval augmented generation means you can give it your notes and all the PDFs you're working with and so on, and it's able to use all of your personal context in the generation of those tools. So, you know, the writing's on the wall. A couple of years from now, I think we're going to have local models on device that can draw in, you know, everything you've got in your notes and your readings and so on. And it's going to be very powerful. I think as long as, you know, the lawsuits don't mess it all up, rightfully so.
We, we're running the MyMac Sparky backend. I've got one person primarily helping me, and we run it all off a Notion instance, and they have an artificial intelligence tool that now indexes everything in your Notion database. So it runs AI with the data set of everything you've added to Notion. And like, we've got a section in there called questions and answers. Whenever either one of us has a question, we write it down and we answer it. And I was looking at that the other day, and it's getting pretty big, and there's a lot of them in there. And I was thinking I could use the Notion AI to query that now and just get it. And I think that's the kind of thing that is interesting to me, to see that coming forward. But I'm gonna check out MindMac, because looking at the screenshot, there's a lot of sliders here, and that's the kind of stuff that gets me excited, where you can change the parameters, not only of what the search term is, but you can change how the engine responds, and you know whether it's aiming to be more creative or more precise, or you know all the different sliders they have. So I like that, and I'm gonna check this out.
And it's worth noting there are some potential cost savings too. It depends on your usage, but the using an API key via a tool like MindMac or MacGPT or what have you tends to be a bit cheaper than $20 a month. I think I've spent $14 so far, and I've been using it for a month and a half. So not a huge cost savings, but it's there.
Yeah, but it just seems more powerful. I mean, in terms of there's more switches and buttons I can throw. And
that's right.
And that hopefully helps me do better. An interesting use of artificial intelligence I've just picked up on recently, which actually came from a listener in the Productivity Field Guide. We did a webinar, and Ward had this really great thing. We were talking about the Apple Watch Ultra, and he has used it now to just make a recording. You know, the app just press record, and he has it do a recording, and then just press record, then he can ship off using Hazel to artificial intelligence, Mac Whisper, I think is the one he was using, to transcribe it for him. And so now anytime he goes anywhere, he can just push the button and talk. And it doesn't transcribe on the watch screen. It just records your voice, but then it uses artificial intelligence. And AI transcription has got remarkably good in a remarkably short time. I mean, it is shocking how good it is now, and which led me down a rabbit hole. So now I'm doing a slightly different workflow. I'm using an app called Whisper Memos, which you can get for your devices. I talked about it in the labs, but they've got a watch app. And Whisper Memos has the ability to send out it does the transcription. What I like about Whisper Memos is it tries to organize paragraphs. I found generally the AI transcription tools are very bad at paragraphs so far. Right. You know, next week that could change. But this one does a good job of it, and it has the advantages. Once it does the transcription, it can automatically email it. And I think the idea was to email it to yourself, right? You know, and so you've got an email. But instead, Drafts has a mail drop now.
Right.
So if you've got a Drafts account, you have a magic email address. And so I just press the action button on my watch. I talk to Whisper Memos about whatever it is I'm doing. And then it emails the transcription to Drafts. And then next time I open Drafts, it's just sitting there waiting for me. And I'm like, that is AI at its best for me in 2024. Yeah. You know, that kind of stuff.
You can see we're getting closer and closer to those like futuristic concept technology videos that Apple made one a long time ago where somebody's just talking at a computer and it's doing stuff. And I know there's been a few from Microsoft's labs too. And you can see it. It's maybe we will eventually get there to that Neuromancer world.
Well, you know, I think the one you're talking about is a knowledge navigator, which is like,
I think so. That's
legendary.
Right.
I'll put it in the notes where Apple kind of had this idea. And it's like, I think that's the kind of thing that would have never happened if Steve Jobs were in charge. You know, I don't think he wanted to get people's expectation about a product that he couldn't sell, but
rightfully so.
But it's there. And like when I was talking earlier about the glasses, I feel like an inherent component of the glasses is an AI that can assist you as you go through the day, as you're wearing the glasses. Truly the analogy everybody makes is to the Marvel movie with Tony Stark and his glasses. Man, you know, I'm a Star Wars person, but I can't remember the name of his assistant.
Jarvis.
Yeah. It's like the Jarvis existence where you walk into a room and it says, oh, that's Ryan. And he's getting his PhD. And, you know, it just like drops knowledge on you wherever you are contextually. And I think it's achievable in our lifetime. And it seems like they're making progress to it very quickly now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's achievable too. I'd wonder how well it's going to work. Going back to our earlier conversation about knowledge augmentation and how well these technologies actually will help us do what we need. And there's always a danger, of course, of dependency. And the analogy might be that idea that came out a couple of years ago from, I think it was a feature article on The Verge about how new university students would be asked by the professors to, you know, download a file and open it up on their file system, and they couldn't do it because they were so used to the idea of search and the way Google Drive sort of smartly organizes folders that they just had no mental model for folders in a file system. So obviously there's lots of vestigial things we can maybe get rid of there. But at the same time, the more we let these tools do for us, the more at risk we are of sort of depending on them and maybe in a bad way. And so there's some obvious caveats there and consequences that we don't need to get into, but it's worth always remembering the double edge.
Oh yeah. And, you know, talk about the crisis of focus, wait until everybody has a screen in front of their eyeballs 24/7. I mean, it's bad enough, right, with the screen in your pocket. I haven't gone there. I do think there's a risk, but my take on all of this is us Mac Power users should be looking at these tools in ways we can use them to our benefit. And I understand there are societal impacts and there are definite risks for people. I think we didn't take the smartphone revolution serious enough and its impact on children. And hopefully we learn that lesson by the time this other stuff becomes, you know, more mobile and available. But that stuff is all there. But at the same time, we can use this stuff to be more productive, to get better work done, and hopefully have more time to enjoy life. That's the goal, at least. This episode of the Mac Power Users is brought to you by Indeed. Go to Indeed.com/MPU and join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide using Indeed to hire great talent fast. When you're hiring, it feels amazing to finally close out a job search. But what if you get rid of the search and just match? You can with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. So ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And it doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared with other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. The killer feature of Indeed really is the matching. Once you decide exactly what you're looking for, they have already got people for you. They just match and give you candidates that match your requirements. Then you can find the right fit, the person that really works for you, and get a successful hire with the minimum amount of work. Using Indeed saves you time, but also gets you a better hire at the same time. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, their matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use it, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/MPU. Just go to Indeed.com/MPU right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Once again, Indeed.com/MPU, terms and conditions apply. Do you need to hire? You need Indeed. And our thanks to Indeed for sponsoring the Mac Power Users and all of Relay FM. Ryan, there's no way we can have you on without talking about Obsidian a little bit because you use it so effectively. You are, in my mind, one of the best Obsidian power users because you do make it work for you, but you don't. My general impression of you is like you don't, your fiddle factor is low. You don't like fiddle with that much, or at least you don't show me all the fiddling you're doing. But you also like really make it work for you as a teacher and as a dad and all of the different areas of your life. You've really managed to incorporate that tool to help you, you know, get your work done and keep track of information. So what are you doing with Obsidian these days?
So yeah, it is still my life and work. I think maybe the key sort of takeaway is that it's not necessarily about Obsidian. I think that there are some unique things about Obsidian and its plugin ecosystem that make it far and away the best example of this. And I've got lots to say about that, but the real key takeaway is for folks to stop thinking about these tools as notes apps and to start thinking about them as, and yes, I will use my coined term, but integrated thinking environments as places where you can sort of put in, we'll call it data, but I'll tell a story about my family in a bit that might give you a different idea about what exactly data is. These are tools where you can put in data and then interact with it in all kinds of amazing ways. It is the truest kind of personal information system that we've ever had. And so I continue to use and love Obsidian. It's true that it's not true that I don't fiddle with it problematically, but return on that is, everybody, I think, who's interested in these things, by definition, fiddle with whatever they're working with, whether you're switching back and forth between apps or you're fiddling with the like Obsidian ecosystem. I think it's all the same. But my fiddling has definitely gone way down as I've sort of become more invested and integrated with this tool. I like to think about how we are all cyborgs now, right? We don't look like RoboCop, but we're deeply integrated with the tools that we work with, and it's almost intractably so. And I, for whatever reason, I'm an optimist about that. I don't see it as a problematic dependency. I definitely see these tools as enhancing who I am and who I want to be. And so I've got a variety of sort of simple ways of talking about Obsidian, but maybe we should just jump to that parenting one because it's the most, or family one because it's the most dramatic. Do you want to go there?
Yeah, yeah. What are you doing?
Sure. So one of the things so I've got a toddler and an infant. And one of the things that my wife and I really want to be able to do is, like anybody, capture all the like cutesy memories and stories of our family and be able to share them and reflect on them over time, right? We both have heard the same stories about us as children from our parents over and over again. And one of the things that we reflected on when we were becoming parents is like, how do we escape that? Like, surely there's more to us than those like four stories that my parents like to tell about me. So is there some way of sort of dealing with that and thinking about that? And we ended up coming up with this story system that we're really excited about, and it's working really well. And so it's a combination of tools, right? It's not just Obsidian, but Obsidian happens to be sort of where things are stored and displayed. But we've got an iMac in the kitchen, and we have this shortcut on our phone called Save Story. And when something happens, or when we think of something, remember something, reminisce, and we know we haven't captured it, we hit that button and it asks for a simple text input, right? It says, you know, what's the story? And we write down some phrase that captures exactly what happened, that allows us to, that we know we'll be able to remember exactly what that is, right? And this is for beyond photos. We all have photos. We all have photos of the events and some, you know, spontaneous photos that are beautiful and capture really great moments of our family's lives. But there's obviously also a lot of things that you can't photograph. And you might never be able to capture on video. And that's what this is for. So we hit save story. We punch in our little phrase that captures exactly what it is. My daughter used to say cuzwise as instead of saying because, she would say cuzwise for whatever reason. So we captured that. And now on the iMac via Keyboard Maestro and an automation I have there, at several times during the day, namely just before mealtimes, breakfast and supper, and then late in the evening, the iMac will wake up. It'll shift from the beautiful photo screensaver that we've got to showing the family calendar on one side of the screen and Obsidian, a special vault in Obsidian, on the other. And all that vault displays is a random story. And so my daughter can't read yet, but my wife and I certainly can. And as we're in the kitchen, you know, the iMac will wake up, we'll see it change as we're preparing supper, and it'll show us one of those, I think we've probably got 100 at this point, stories of our little family's life so far. And the latest innovation that we came up with that's really cool is we've started recording the full story. So we'll sit down occasionally in the evenings, look at a couple of them, and just do a quick audio recording, which you can do in Obsidian, of course, but you could do with any other tool out there. And we save that recording to that note that represents the story. And we're using this little tool called a Yodo player. It's this kid-friendly media player. That's this little box that uses NFC cards that you insert into the player in order to play audio. Okay. And we were saving those stories to the Yodo player. And so our daughter now has a collection of stories about our family's life in the Yodo that she can hear. But also as she, you know, grows up, as both of our kids grow up, they'll be able to interact with this vault and listen to these stories just by looking at the notes so that they can reminisce themselves or, you know, begrudge their parents for making fun of them their entire lives. But either way, you know, that's the kind of data that we're capturing in that vault is simple phrases that represent some story and then an audio recording of exactly what happened and why it was so cute or funny or representative of who our kids are. And we really love it. It's one of the best things that I think I've made as a result of all these automations in all my experience so far.
And I bet your daughter just loves hearing those stories, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Lately she's we've only been doing that for about a month, but she does request that card more often than say the Peppa Pig one, thank God, or any of the others, which is really nice to see.
When my kids were little and I would tell them stories, I would always include them as a character in the story. And that was a big deal, you know? And then it got to a point where I'd start telling a story and 10, 15 minutes in, they'd say, well, what about me? Where am I in this one? And they'd want to know. And I think that's very common for kids, but what a wonderful little capture method. And, you know, I keep saying this about Obsidian, but that advantage of it being locally stored data and not in any format means that this can move with you to whatever the new thing is in 10 years. No problem.
Right.
And that's probably the most sticky thing about Obsidian for me. Every time I get tempted to move some data out of there, I'm like, no, because now I just own this. It's mine. And nothing else really does that. It's just such an odd tool in that regard, because so many of the PKM, I'm holding up air quote, apps are all about owning the data and putting it in some kind of odd database format where Obsidian just puts it on your drive. I love that. For people who want a copy at home, So you're making the shortcut. I'm assuming it's just saving the text file to your Obsidian database or Vault.
Yeah, it just saves a text file to an iCloud folder. That's where I'm storing the Vault.
Yeah.
And then the maybe part of the magic there is the like little bit of an Obsidian. It's called Data View, but it's just a way of showing. I have a little Data View script that shows one random file from that Vault, right?
Yeah.
It's very simple, but it's very like the simplest things are the most robust, right?
Knowing you, I suspect that you spent more time making that random subroutine than most people would. Am I right?
Maybe. Yeah, I think that one, I made a really involved readings automation that I confess I never really use, but it pulls together random readings that I haven't read yet and puts them on my daily note in Obsidian so that I can sort of every day get a reading list that I could tap into if I want. That one took a long time, but then, you know, the beauty of automation and scripting is that I was able to just copy and paste a snippet from that and you put it in this family vault and then now it works. It lives on at driving the story system.
Yeah, that's nice. That is nice. We always like to finish up talking about favorite apps and services, things that bring you joy and delight that maybe people haven't heard of. What mm-hmm. are your favorite apps and services these days?
Yeah, I've got a few that I can dive into that we haven't had time to talk about yet. One, we briefly mentioned time blocking earlier. So quick side note to differentiate time blocking from time tracking. Time blocking is the idea that you look ahead in your calendar and you take a task that you need to work on and you give it a block of time that is an event in your calendar. And it's obviously a nice idea, but it's hard to practice. And I've been trying for many months to sort of get into that habit of time blocking. And I have been successful thanks to a little utility called Rules. And I'll have to, it's one of those apps that is impossible to search for because it's such a simple name.
Yeah, it's called Rules. Yeah.
Yeah, we'll link it in the show notes. But it's an answer to an automation problem that I've had for years. It allows you to trigger shortcuts from your calendar events. So you give it a calendar and you say, take events in this calendar, and then it will run any shortcut you want at a given time, either like at the start of that event or 10 minutes before it or whatever. So I have this time blocking calendar and I put time blocks in it. And then when those events happen, it triggers a shortcut that minimizes every window, thanks to a little Apple script, puts up a little prompt, a little text prompt that says like, here's what you said you were going to work on. What are you going to do to start that? And activates a focus app that blocks access to, you know, all the distractions. And so I've been using that now for a couple of months, and it's really helping me stick to this time blocking thing. And I'm able to make, obviously, like sort of the undercurrent to this topic is I obviously have some attentional deployment issues or discipline issues. And you can maybe audience members want to be crotchety and say that I should just have discipline. But, you know, lots of folks have the same problems that I have. And it's been a really wonderful way of tackling that. I can't believe that this is the only answer to that calendar event automation, but it's been really fantastic. And I'm really grateful that somebody built it and released it like 6 months ago.
Yeah. So first of all, I don't know how I wasn't aware of this, but I'm not. And now you have completely messed up my time blocks because you just wrecked the rest of my day. I'm looking at this app and I'm like, okay, here we go. But I do like the idea, like as you try to adopt time blocking, to try and incorporate what I call, for lack of a better word, setups to it. Like, so this is going to be time to work on this thing. And I would imagine maybe you have it open up Obsidian to a certain vault and a certain workflow that you have, or your research page or whatever it is that you want to do, just to make it easier for yourself to make that shift into the next block and get working.
That's right. Yeah, actually, the other piece of this is that I create my time blocks from Obsidian. So I use Mac Stories has a plugin for Obsidian called Shortcuts Launcher, and it allows you to select some text and then it'll send that text and the note name that the text is in and a bunch of other things if you want to any given shortcut. So in Obsidian, I'm working on a project. I select a task and I hit my block time shortcut, and then it sends that text and the note name and stuff to a shortcut that then finds the next available block in my calendar and creates that time block with a link to the note. And then Rules could, I've never actually thought about it, but obviously it's something I should do. Rules can launch the URL in that calendar event after it executes. So when my time block starts, launch that app. or launch that note. That'd be a great idea.
Yeah, the contextual computing is a thing, and I think the more you can make it easy, the better it is. And that, this is like, I feel like on that, you know, bang for your buck productivity curve, this is the kind of stuff that makes the difference between a power user and somebody who's just kind of like, you know, dragging along with the computer. I think you can really make these things work for you harder when you pick up something like that. That's a great workflow, and thanks for sharing it.
Yeah, it's super cool. The other couple things that I thought about mentioning today were, it was a recent discussion on the forum about sort of audio focus apps. And something that I've gotten back into is a tool called Brain.fm. Endel is another one, E-N-D-E-L. And I'm sure there are others, but it plays with this idea of binaural beats. And maybe this is one of those scientific topics that is currently unresolved, but will turn out to be bogus in the future. But there is some evidence, at least, for the efficacy of these binaural beats tools in training your brain waves to go to a certain state. So lately I've been fighting with that idea, trying to use this tool. And I was using Endel, but found it wouldn't always work. I didn't always like it. And since I switched over to Brain.fm, it's actually been really nice because they play these like long tracks. Actually, a project of mine from 10 years ago during record production month, RPM, which is February, I tried to create an electronic focus music record. It wasn't very good, but this idea nonetheless is really compelling to me that, you know, if we have EDM, electronic dance music, and we have music and video games that is supposed to be able to be played on end forever while you're playing some level, then maybe we can have tracks that are electronic focus music as well. And Brain.fm has hit that out of the park. They have these long, beautiful tracks. You can select a variety of genres. And in the background of this is the somewhat science-based idea of binaural beats, training your brainwaves to be either more, to help you be more attending to whatever it is you want to focus on, or to be a little bit more creative. It seems to have some real effect. So that's been a really neat little utility.
You know, Ryan, I need to probably go back and look at Brain.fm again. I gave it a try years ago when it was kind of new on the scene. And so my situation is a little unique. I have tinnitus, so I always have noise in my ears. So
I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's growing up. I played in a lot of bands. I suspect that had a lot to do with it. But the but it doesn't bother me that much. You know, whenever I mention on the show, people are like, how can you work with all those noise? Well, mine are a minor third between my left ear and my right ear. And you would think that would drive you nuts, but I've just kind of learned to tune it out. But it does help if I have background noise. So like dark noise with the thunderstorm plays hours and hours a day. I would hate to know what the statistic is on how many hours I've listened to that. But then I also have some music and Apple Music. Sometimes I'll play a playlist. And I thought this would be kind of perfect for me, but I just didn't, I don't know. I guess I felt like I should get more out of it, or like suddenly I should feel more focused or something. I don't know. And the few tracks I listened to, I didn't really care for that much. So then I found myself saying, oh, I don't even really like this music. So, so I gave up on it. I think I need to like, and it's also quite expensive, at least it was when I looked at it, but maybe I need to buy a month and just like really like just give it a month and see if it makes a difference.
Right. It's one of those things where I bought a lifetime license a long time ago. And it was expensive at the time too, but you know, every once in a while I make these big bets on ideas and then hopefully they pay off. And Brain.fm, I agree. Earlier on, I tried it for a while. I actually had great success with it for a number of months, and then maybe I got bored with it. But then when I checked it out a month ago because of that forum conversation, I realized that they've changed quite a bit. They have a bunch of updates to the software. It's no longer, it used to be really sort of clunky. Now it's pretty elegant. And because of the introduction of genres, you can actually opt out of like lo-fi. I don't like lo-fi when I'm working, for instance. Deselected that.
Yeah.
And you can, the tracks that I've been getting have been generally great. And they have that benefit of the binaural beats in the background too.
Well, Ryan, people want to find you. They can go over to fulcra.design, FULCRA.design. Like I said, you're one of my favorite people on the internet. I love all the stuff you're doing and the way you've brought your academic career down to the masses. And like, you're one of my favorite contributors in the Mac Power Users forums. And I just encourage you to keep sharing what you're doing, because I think you're helping a lot of people.
Thanks. Yeah, I appreciate you having me on again, and it was lovely meeting up in California. Hopefully we'll be able to meet up again sometime.
All right. We want to thank our sponsors. That's 1Password, NetSuite, and Indeed. We are the Mac Power Users. You can find us at relay.fm/MPU. You can sign up for the forums at talk.macpowerusers.com. And if you'd like to get the extended ad-free version of the show, you can do that over at relay.fm/MPU. We'd love to have you join us. Ryan and I and more power users today are going to be talking about his Outlook woes. And anybody who's used Outlook knows exactly what we're talking about. Otherwise, we'll see you next week.